to the Very Well Mind podcast. We've interviewed over 100 authors, experts, entrepreneurs, athletes, musicians, and others to help you learn strategies to care for your mental health. This episode is hosted by psychotherapist and best-selling author Amy Morin. Now let's get into the episode. Today, I'm talking to Michael Baldwin and Deborah Korn. They co-authored a book together called Every Memory Deserves Respect. Debbie is an EMDR therapist, and Michael is an advocate of EMDR. After experiencing it for himself and undergoing an extreme transformation, he now loves to tell other people about the benefits. EMDR, if you're not familiar, is a type of treatment that's used specifically to help people heal from trauma. Debbie and Michael will explain more about what it is and how it works during this episode. Some of the things they talk about today are how traumatic experiences affect us, what happens during an EMDR therapy session, and why it's so effective. Make sure to stick around until the end of the episode for the therapist take. It's the part of the show where I'll give you my take on the strategies Michael and Debbie share and explain how you can apply them to your own life. So here's Michael Baldwin and Deborah Korn on how EMDR therapy might help you heal from trauma. Michael Baldwin and Dr. Debbie Korn, welcome to the Very Well Mind podcast.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. I'm excited to talk to you both. I came across your book called Every Memory Deserves Respect. But as a therapist myself, I happen to know that the initials EMDR also stands for something else. So I was excited to check out why you wrote this book and to hear a little bit more about it. So maybe before we dive in, though, maybe you can explain a little bit about what EMDR is, Debbie.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe let's start with the acronym EMDR. EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Now, desensitization refers to the reduction of distress, of fear, of anxiety. And reprocessing refers to the reevaluation or the restructuring of thoughts and beliefs, and basically the transformation of one sense of self relative to past traumatic experiences. It's about moving the past into the past so one can live more fully in the present. And then there's the eye movement part. Now, Francine Shapiro, the developer of EMDR, accidentally discovered back in the late 80s that purposely moving your eyes horizontally back and forth while focusing on traumatic memories leads to a reduction in the vividness and the emotional intensity of the memory. So she developed an effective protocol for treating PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and trauma-related problems using this bilateral, this back-and-forth eye movement stimulation. And she published the first research study on this approach in 1989, working with rape survivors and Vietnam combat veterans. So hence the name eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And basically, EMDR is a memory-focused psychotherapy that helps people deal with the impact and the legacy of trauma and the adverse experiences in their lives. And it's based on the idea that psychological problems are related to a failure to adequately process traumatic experiences and memories. And we know that, you know, we process experiences all the time, every day, right? We go to a party, we see our friends, we come home that night, we reflect on the experience, we talk to our partner about it, maybe we dream about it that night, but by the next day, we've processed it through. But something very different appears to happen when an experience is traumatic, when it's overwhelming and associated with, you know, extreme vulnerability and powerlessness. It appears that that memory gets frozen or locked in the nervous system. And it gets locked in the nervous system with all of the feelings, the sensations, the beliefs that were part, the images that were part of the original experience. And then along comes a trigger that kind of reactivates that experience, leading to symptoms. So that frozen constellation of experience can affect the way we perceive things, the decisions we make, reactions we have, beliefs we hold about ourselves and others. And in EMDR therapy, we help clients access and activate their unprocessed traumatic memories with a set of very focused questions And then we jumpstart the brain's information processing system, which is kind of stalled out at some level, using the bilateral stimulation. And with EMDR reprocessing, a client's distress eventually decreases in any given session where we're working on a particular memory, and relevant adaptive information, helpful information held in other parts of the brain, present day perspectives get integrated. So we move to, it's really over, right? I'm safe now. I was only a kid doing the best that I could. It wasn't my fault. I'm okay. I'm good enough. I'm in control now. I have choices. So as I said, we move the past into the past and help people to move more fully into the present, taking in present day information in a new way. And there are shifts in thoughts, feelings, behaviors, physical sensations. Healing involves kind of this spontaneous movement toward more positive thinking, more adaptive thinking, more manageable feelings, and a significant reduction in the level of disturbance experienced in one's body.
Yeah, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist by trade. Mm-hmm. So when I first heard about EMDR, I was a little bit skeptical because I thought it's not really about the eye movement part of this, but it's probably just more about exposure therapy, because we know when we're experience something traumatic, we kind of shove it down. Mm-hmm, we don't want to think about it. We go to great lengths. And so sometimes talking about it can help, but there is this piece about the eye movement. Can you just talk briefly about that?
Yeah, sure. So again, you hear me using the term bilateral stimulation, and bilateral stimulation refers to any facilitated stimulation that challenges the client to orient or track laterally back and forth with their attention, stimulating both sides of the brain. The methodology began with eye movements, but over the years, we've discovered that many different forms of bilateral stimulation can be effective, many kinds of stimulation. So a therapist may have a client wear headphones that kind of beep back and forth, one ear, then the other, then the other. We ask the client to put their hands on their laps and we tap back and forth between the two hands. The therapist taps back and forth. We have the client cross their arms over their chest and tap back and forth. So there's many different modalities that we can use that facilitate this bilateral stimulation. What we know today about the effects of bilateral stimulation is a lot more than what we knew 30 years ago when EMDR was first introduced to the world. There have been, I think, over 30 randomized controlled trials that substantiate the positive effects of eye movement. So in the early days, a lot of people said, oh, this is nothing more than exposure therapy. But in fact, what we know now is that the eye movements or the bilateral stimulation is not a bogus component. It absolutely has a very important effect. And now we can unequivocally report that eye movements reduce negative emotions, reduce imagery vividness, and overall reduce emotional arousal intensity. And eye movements appear to increase or enhance memory retrieval, the ability to access, recognition of true information. So it helps people to discern kind of more accurate adaptive information, and it leads to more positive neurophysiological changes and more flexible thinking.
And who doesn't want all that? And I think one of the great things about EMDR that I've learned is that it can also be short term. Sometimes we think that doing work on trauma is going to be a decade of stirring up all of these things, but sometimes people get better really fast, right?
Well, you know, what we know from the early studies, like from the very beginning, early research, about 90% of adults dealing with kind of single episode trauma, like a car accident, a rape, an assault, a traumatic loss, 90% of adults dealing with a single episode trauma were able to eliminate or significantly reduce their PTSD symptoms in 3 to 4 sessions. And a research study with Bessel van der Kolk that I was involved in back in the early 2000s, comparing EMDR to Prozac in the treatment of adult PTSD, involved 8 sessions of EMDR compared to a comparable period of time on Prozac. And EMDR was ultimately superior to Prozac in reducing both PTSD symptoms and depression. And by the end of treatment, all of those in the EMDR group with adult-only traumas had lost their PTSD diagnosis. So we're not talking about folks with childhood trauma, but folks that had adult trauma lost their PTSD diagnosis after 8 sessions of EMDR, along with 75% of those with childhood trauma histories. And 6 months later, after no additional trauma treatment, no additional EMDR, almost 90% of the child abuse survivors had lost their PTSD diagnosis, and a third were completely asymptomatic. And we were just blown away by the results of that study. The last thing I'll say about the time element is that there is recently, in the last couple of years, there was a meta-analysis that found EMDR to be the most cost-efficient of the 11 trauma treatments that were evaluated in this study. So not only did they find that EMDR was effective, but they found that it was particularly cost-efficient.
So promising to hear all of those things.
Yeah, and it is.
I want to turn to you, Michael. It's one thing when Debbie says, yes, this definitely works, or when I, as a therapist as well, say people should get EMDR treatment. But you are somebody that has tried it and have become a big proponent of it. And you're one of those people whose trauma started in childhood. Do you want to talk just a little bit about some of the trauma that you had been through?
Yes. And keep in mind, I was unaware of it until I was in my 60s, until I met Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita. And to be clear for the audience, Dr. Magnavita is my therapist. Debbie is my co-author. So Debbie was not my therapist. So my trauma history is about abuse and neglect, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, and neglect, which was really pervasive and willful and had a profound effect on me that I wasn't aware of until very late, you know, much, much later in my life. And so I think it's not uncommon, the trauma gets buried and you come up with a survival strategy. And in my case, when I had a core belief that I was basically worthless, because that's by deduction as a child, probably even pre-verbally. So my strategy was a grandiosity strategy. So I became a status and achievement junkie and a workaholic and obsessed with all external symbols of achievement and success, and running the Boston Marathon and getting a job in advertising in 13 days. Spending 3 years and getting myself into medical school, and then not going because I could check the box that I got myself into medical school. So it all finally, I guess the other important dimension of my story for your audience is it wasn't like I wasn't trying, because I started in Boston when I was in my 20s with a therapist and went through, Dr. Magnavita was the 8th therapist that I saw over 22 years. And none of the therapists, if you could believe this, ever mentioned the word trauma. None of them knew anything about EMDR. It never even came up. And the day I walked into Dr. Magnavita's office, both of those things came to the surface almost immediately with him.
Impressive that you were willing to keep trying after seeing that many different therapists. What kind of symptoms did you have that you realized needed to be treated? Because sometimes when people are overachievers, they think, you know, I'm doing well in life. Clearly, look at all of the success I've had. And they don't necessarily recognize that there's also a problem.
I was incapable of any kind of intimate relationships. I was had anxiety. I had a depression. I had phobias I was dealing with, even though at the time I didn't know what a phobia was. I guess one of the most extreme examples was, these are all sort of private to me, starting when I was a boy. I mean, when I was a boy, in public school, the notion of going into the boys' room and using the stall was anathema completely. I mean, panic-inducing anathema. And I lived in fear of things like that all the time. As an adult, the suggestion of any kind of intimacy with a woman was full-blown panic. And I even had an episode as an adult with a woman where I had invited her for a weekend. I had a house I was renting, and I said goodnight to her. She was upstairs, I was downstairs. And the whole thing, like, you know, don't worry, you know, this is a very safe environment. Shortly thereafter, she came downstairs to my bedroom in her nightgown, and I blacked out. I don't even know what happened after that. I just blacked out. So, and the other thing about phobias is I literally thought this is just the way I was. I didn't even know what a phobia was. I guess this is just the way I react, and this is just the way I am. No connection between the phobias and the trauma. No connection between the symptoms and the trauma. And Debbie, you started to ask a question a second ago.
Yeah, go ahead.
And Michael, the nightmares as well was an important part.
I had two recurring nightmares over decades, exactly the same, never any different, and never any more terrifying. One was having to do with being at the top of the Empire State Building and falling off and being conscious all the way down to the end, to hitting the sidewalk. No idea what it was or where it came from. And the other one was this complete panic fear of being incarcerated because I'd been an accomplice to a crime, and the police had now found out that I was an accomplice. So they were coming to get me, and I'd be incarcerated, and I would never, ever, ever get out. Mm. And I would wake up, you know, 6 months before I started seeing Dr. Magnavita, in the middle of the night, in a complete and total panic. The intensity of the fear and the terror was never, ever diminished. And the scenario of those two nightmares never changed. Didn't know where they came from. Didn't know why I was having them.
So when you found a therapist who first told you about EMDR, did it sound like something that was intriguing? What was your response to it? Or did it sound like it was a little hokey?
My sister recommended Dr. Magnavita. And actually, I don't think, I didn't really know about it until I was in his office. And he said, we were spending some time together, obviously. And he introduced the notion that I think these symptoms are trauma related. And I would like to work with you with a certain therapeutic approach called EMDR. And at that point, I was at such a nadir that if he had said, I'd like you to stand on one leg and bounce this ball and sing happy birthday, I would have done it.
And how soon did you start to get relief from your symptoms after you started?
From the very first day I saw him.
Really?
Very first day. I mean, it was as if by that point, it was almost like the water, the emotions and all that stuff, it was so bad, was just about to burst out. And, you know, the first time I saw him, it was for 4.5 hours. And just waves and waves of grief, I remember, and convulsive crying and this longing and crying and unhappiness and this is so long since since pre-verbal of just being isolated and alone and neglected, and no one's coming to take care of me. No one's coming to feed me. I don't know what's going to happen. The mind of a child, of an infant. And at the end, I remember him asking, he said, Michael, I'm guessing you're exhausted right now. I said, no, I'm not exhausted. I have such profound relief right now. I felt like I had 2 gallons more lung capacity after that first session.
And Debbie, is that a typical response from somebody's first EMDR session?
I don't know what a typical response is, because everyone responds differently to EMDR. Everyone's first session looks different. But what I will say is it's not unusual for clients to have some anxiety, some fear, some hesitancy. Clients certainly say, this sounds kind of wacky. What are you asking me to do? Right. And I often share with people, you know, that we have 3 decades of research in support of EMDR, that it's been it's been vetted, it's been endorsed by organizations around the world as a top tier treatment. I let people know I've been doing the work for 30 years and I'm going to be right there with you. I'm going to be at your side. And, you know, once we get the motivation up to engage and people are really able to engage in it, it is not unusual for people to have a profound experience in the first session, the first few sessions. It feels different than anything they've ever experienced before. And, you know, it's not unusual for clients to start to put together pieces of their story or to connect the dots in a way that they've never, in a visceral, experiential way, you know, in a way that's really, really quite new to them and then quite promising, quite hopeful because it feels so new and different. So, you know, we know that trauma is cumulative. So the more trauma that someone has, the more chronic, the more complex their trauma history is, the longer, you know, the work is potentially going to take because we've got more targets to work on. So it's, you know, the length of treatment is going to be different depending on what someone shows up with. But can someone who has had a chronic history of trauma, who's had a lot of childhood trauma like Michael, feel a huge impact in an initial session or in the first few sessions yet?
And Michael, do you remember how did it come to be that you shared your story? If you sit down with a therapist and they say, tell me your trauma history, you didn't even necessarily know you had a trauma history. So how did it come to be that you opened up the right can of worms to say, here's what's going on and here's what I need to talk about to heal?
I think Dr. Magnavita would say, the minute he laid eyes on me, he could see a level of distress that was remarkable because I just, you know, I had spent decades doing two things. One, trying to hold a beach ball under the surface of the water and all the energy that takes to keep the trauma, you know, repressed. Yeah. And two, trying to maintain this facade, this status and achievement junkie facade. I was at work, I was in advertising and, you know, my lifestyle, it was just flying all over all the time in this crazy lifestyle I had. You know, I was running the biggest piece of business in the advertising business, the IBM account globally, at arguably the best agency in the world, Ogilvy & Mather in their New York office. So those two things going on simultaneously, and yet just feeling eroded and more and more every day. So when I got to him, I was just a wreck. Mm-hmm. And I think I didn't open a can of worms. I think Dr. Magnavita could see what was going on, and he is the one who guided me.
I was just going to add to that, you know, a trained EMDR therapist, a skillful EMDR therapist begins with the client's symptoms in the present, right? Most clients don't walk in and say, I'm here to work on my childhood memories from age 5 to age 7. Or, you know, sometimes people do. Sometimes people come in and say, I want to work on the abuse by my father or my mother. But most of the time, people come in and say, I'm miserable, I hate myself, my marriage is falling apart, I'm having panic attacks. And we begin with the most recent experience of distress, and we orient the client to their body, to their thoughts, to their emotions that are fresh, that are active in the moment. And we invite them to float back, to kind of follow, close their eyes, follow back along those symptoms, along that experience, to perhaps the earliest time or the worst time they experienced anything like that. And some people float back 5 years, and then they might go 10 years, and they might go all the way back to childhood. But we are trained to look for the memories that are still most alive, kicking around in the nervous system. And then that becomes the target. That becomes a beginning target. And I suspect, I wasn't there with Michael and Jeffrey Magnavita, but I suspect that Jeffrey quickly assessed that these were PTSD symptoms, trauma-related symptoms, and had you, you know, really looking at the highest distress in the present and looking at what that might look back to. So.
And Amy, in response to this, you said, why did you write the book? I figured that if I, after so many years searching, trying, eight, you know, seven therapists, had never heard about trauma, had no idea what EMDR therapy was. And knowing that it basically, you know, saved my life, I figured if that's what my situation was, well, it stands to reason that probably maybe most of the lay public have no idea either, who also are probably suffering because trauma is a part of life. There's no getting around it. There's no avoiding it. You know, and Debbie can talk more about that. So that's, I want to do it. And I also want to do it, I told you, with the, with almost a non-verbal way, with an image about a concept, with opposite text, very, very simple. So that, as we talk about often now, it's kind of two books in one. There's kind of the picture book, and then there's the textbook. And you could, you know, you could take one at a time or both or whatever. But I wanted to do something like that. So no matter what your language was, what your country was, you can understand when they're holding the guy's holding a piece of amber and they're trapped, perfectly preserved 35 million year old flower is in there. Whether I'm Roman or Spanish or French or Israeli, I understand that when the opposite text says trauma is frozen like this flower is frozen, perfectly preserved unless and until it's attended to.
And you do a great job in the book of really outlining here the symptoms that can happen after somebody experiences trauma. Here's some of the behaviors that we often see, things that you might not necessarily associate with it. I know people who come into my therapy office will usually think of PTSD in terms of combat veterans, right, and nightmares. Right. But they don't necessarily see that, like, people-pleasing and being a workaholic can often be associated with it as well. Yes. So it is a surprise to them. And I'm sorry that you had to see so many therapists before anybody recognized it. That does not speak very well about our profession, that many therapists didn't recognize that in you or bring it up. Because I think the truth is, I guess the statistics that I've read, Debbie, are usually like 80% of us have experienced a major trauma in life.
Yeah.
Is that
70-80%. And I, you know, it's interesting you're bringing that up, Amy, because I was just thinking about that this morning, that's always the statistic that I hold in my head. And it's the statistic that I spit out in interviews. But we're living in a world right now that, you know, every other day we open up the newspaper and there's some sort of mass shooting, right? We're dealing with climate change. We're dealing with, you know, violence in politics. And people's nervous systems are really rattling. You know, they're really struggling on a day-to-day basis. You know, we're coming out of this pandemic, hopefully coming out of this pandemic, and people's nervous systems are not the same that they were 3 years ago. You know, their nervous systems are much more vulnerable, which then in turn, I think, makes people more vulnerable to experience the stressors of life as traumatic experiences, as overwhelming, as threatening, as life-threatening experiences. And so I'm really curious to hear what that statistic is going to look like a year from now. I'm worried.
Yeah, we used to think that you had to experience the trauma firsthand, like you had to be the one who was in the accident in order to develop PTSD. After 9/11, we looked at, wow, everybody saw this plane crash into a building, and people became jumpy just because they saw that happen, and people were on edge. So maybe you don't need to experience it firsthand, but just reading about it, seeing it, knowing that these things are happening can be enough to stir up trauma in people.
Well, right. And you know, the truth is that that it depends who you are and what your story is, what your life history is, to determine how you're going to respond to these kinds of stressors. Like, I had a lot of people over the course of this pandemic with significant childhood trauma histories who were coming in terrified, triggered by what was happening in the news, what was happening in terms of the pandemic, in ways that I wasn't seeing in my folks that didn't have that severe trauma history. So because people were carrying this trauma in their nervous system from childhood, they were so much more vulnerable to being affected by what was going on, by witnessing things, by that vicarious traumatization than the next person. So you're absolutely right. You know, just witnessing it, bearing witness to it, can have an effect. Small T traumas, not just big T traumas, can have an effect. You know, we think about the shock traumas, the kinds of traumas that most anyone would consider a trauma, an earthquake, combat, a 9/11, you know, a car accident, a major assault. But we now know that people can wind up with post-traumatic stress symptoms and trauma-related symptoms when they're exposed to smaller T traumas, you know, a divorce, losing a job, a difficult move, a discovery of a partner's affair, right? And we also know that trauma involves both omission and commission, right? Things that happen to you that are committed against you, and experiences where things that are supposed to happen don't happen. So folks that grow up in environments where there's deprivation, where there's neglect, where they weren't protected, where they weren't believed, that can have an impact as well. You know, in adulthood, when, you know, you report something that has happened to you, you go to the police and you're not believed. That in and of itself can be a trauma. You come home from combat. I'm thinking about my Vietnam combat veterans who came home from combat and, you know, were called names and were not, you know, honored for their service. So trauma can be big T, it can be little T, it can be omission, it can be commission. And we know that it's both objective, like what happens to you, the event itself, and it can be subjective, meaning it's different depending on who you are. The impact is different depending on who you are.
I'm glad you brought that up. So I write books on mental strength, and sometimes people confuse mental strength with saying, well, I got through a traumatic experience and look at me, I'm unscathed.
Right.
And sometimes they can hold it together for a little while. And not everybody develops PTSD or acute stress disorder. Some people do go through tough times and for whatever reason, they don't develop those symptoms and other people do. But what are some of the reasons why some people might be more susceptible to developing PTSD than someone else?
Yeah, you know, some of it has to do simply with biology, with, you know, the way we're made, with genetics. Some of it has to do with the supports in our lives, you know, whether you're believed, whether you get to talk about the experience right after it happened, whether people hold you and, you know, take you seriously. Some of it has to do with whether you have trauma upon trauma upon trauma, right? Whether you've got a jumpy nervous system to start with. So all of those factors, you know, nature and nurture bear down on how someone is going to respond to trauma. And it also depends on whether you are able to stay connected to the trauma, talk about it, feel it, draw about it, dream about it, or whether you're quick to defend against it, to push it away, to compartmentalize it. You know, in Michael's case, his traumatic experiences got tucked away almost immediately. You know, he didn't have any safety in his environment. He was not able to go to anyone and say, this is happening to me, or I don't understand, or I'm feeling scared. And so, you know, when you are quick from the earliest age to dissociate the trauma or to, you know, turn to substances or to numb out, that trauma can stay tucked away and, again, frozen and locked away, compartmentalized in your nervous system for a long time, and it doesn't have the opportunity to get processed through and resolved, even though we have, our brain has the capacity to digest and process and put something up on a shelf. If it gets locked into a compartment, that doesn't happen.
How long were you in therapy, Michael?
With Dr. Megavita, about 2 years. And I should add that is a door that's always open to me. And as certain other things, as I continue my life and certain other things about life become, you know, reality for me, I look forward to being able to go and reengage with him and work through things that that maybe wouldn't be possible to come up because they hadn't arisen. You know, let's say I meet some woman that I'm really intrigued by, and who knows what kind of triggers then will be activated. I know, and I know exactly where I'll be when that happens, and I actually am kind of looking forward to it.
And that's a good point, that sometimes I think people think if you're going to work on something, there's a clear beginning and a clear end, and then it's done and you close that door forever. Well, I work with a lot of kids in foster care. I was a foster parent for a lot of years.
Oh.
children in foster care are an example of somebody that maybe something is triggering for them when they're 20 years old. They get into a relationship, they move away, they meet their partner's parents, whatever it is, but there's different triggers along the way or certain things, sights, sounds, smells that maybe they didn't even recognize were an issue for them, and it might stir something up. So it's always a good idea for them to know, yes, you may have to go to therapy at different stages of your life, and it doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong. It might just be that the circumstances you're in are triggering something new for you. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
Yeah.
How are you doing these days?
Well, there's been a couple of, I'll give one example of the magnitude, in my opinion, of this whole experience. One of the things I dealt with as a boy was bullying. And anybody who's been bullied know that you literally live, as Dr. Bobby B. always would say, you live in a state of terror. There's no ever feeling of safety. So my older brother was my bully, and he was a terrible, terrible physical and mental, emotional bully. Really, really the worst. And then I had a bully in school who targeted me, and it was really horrible. And my brother and I never had any relationship whatsoever, ever. And that continued through adulthood. I remember when I went to my mother's funeral service, I was reluctant to go, but Dr. Magavita suggests I might regret it if I didn't. So the moment I got off the plane, knowing my brother was going to be at that service, all kinds of GI issues happened. And by the time I got there, I was a wreck, barely made it to the service, had to sit in the back row because I kept having to go back to the men's room. Had to stay in my hotel room for 2 days because my inner alarm system was going crazy because my brother was proximal. So Dr. Magavita said, when we're getting ready to publish the book, you cannot publish this book without letting your brother know about it. Reached out to him and he responded, you could say whatever you want to say about me in your book, but if it means that you and I have a chance to have a relationship as brothers, nothing could make me happier. That was about a year and a half ago. Well, right around publication of the book. We have had a Zoom call every Friday since, hour and a half without fail. I look forward to it every single week. We had our very first week together. You can tell I'm in a kind of a rustic environment. I'm in Greensboro, Vermont right now at a lake house. This is where we came to spend the first week as brothers in our lives together ever. And he has become the most important person in my life. And he's here again now, and I'm going to see him today. And it's something like I never in a million years could ever have possibly imagined would be possible. And that's just one example. The depth and intimacy of my own friendships, all of the stuff wholesale that was obsessively paramount to me in my old facade, old grandiosity person, completely irrelevant, completely without any importance whatsoever, to the point where I look at that person, I think, who is that? Who was that? How could that have ever been me? So I don't even think there's any broader or more important brushstroke I could put on a canvas that was more evidence of the effect this has had in my life. Mm-hmm. And I think partnering with Debbie, and you're getting an experience of Debbie right now, a small one, but you still, it's so obvious. I think, the quality of her as a human being, as a professional, as a clinician, as my friend and companion and collaborator, I think is a reflection of the nature of people and things I'm now attracting in my life.
Wow, Michael.
Yeah, I love that idea that you say life is better than you thought it could have been. Mm. And what a change you're seeing in your relationships. Debbie, can you just talk for a little bit about some of the results that you see in your therapy office for people whose lives are changed by EMDR?
Yeah, sure. What Michael didn't mention in his beautiful description of his transformation is that by the end of treatment, every single symptom that he was having had an explanation. He understood why he had those symptoms, where they originated, what they represented. And they were gone, right? The phobias were gone. All of The many phobias that Michael struggled with were gone by the end of treatment. The nightmares were gone by the end of treatment. The fear of intimacy was gone. All of that, you know, what I see in my clients is those acute symptoms that they come into treatment with, be it depression, be it anxiety, be it phobias, be it PTSD symptoms, be it avoidance of, you know, challenges, avoidance of intimacies. We can clear those symptoms. And we see a real shift from being stuck in a place of holding oneself responsible for traumatic experiences, particularly childhood experiences. It was my fault. I was a bad kid. And as a result, I don't deserve good things. I don't belong. We see a shift to, wait a minute, I am good enough. It wasn't my fault. I do deserve. We see a shift from people living from a place of fear, like I'm not safe, the world is dangerous, I'm vulnerable, I can't protect myself, to, you know, I'm an adult, I can take care of myself. I don't have to be afraid. The past is in the past. And we see a shift as well around that powerlessness, the helplessness, the sense of feeling trapped in the world, where people shift to, you know, I have choices, right? I do have control. I can say no. I have boundaries. I can set limits. I can use my voice. Very often in the course of treatment, as people are processing these old experiences, they're able to say or do things in the processing, either in their mind's eye or out loud in the processing. They're able to say or do things like screaming or fleeing or speaking up and saying no, asking for help that they never could do at the time. And that begins to free them up to be able to do that in the present, to use their voice, to use their bodies differently. And people are also in the course of processing, particularly when we're talking about developmental trauma or childhood trauma, folks are able to connect with their younger selves, their child parts, that traumatized child, and offer care, offer repair, offer holding, and do a real reparative piece of work that allows them to re-enter their world in a place where they're so much more gentle with themselves and caring. And I know Michael experienced that. Michael moved from, you know, not taking good care of himself to really learning the importance of nurturing himself and prioritizing self. And Michael, I always love the story about yoga, going to yoga.
Yeah. So parts of self, Amy, was something I never could really understand it with Dr. Magnavita. And then I finally got it. And so I would go to hot yoga every Friday. And during Shavasana, you know, corpse pose, and my eyes closed and I'd be sitting there on my back, and I would just imagine myself sitting there, and over there, a tiny little year and a half old version of me would kind of peek out from behind a rock or something and very cautiously come over and let me put him in my lap. And then I'd see over there maybe a three-year-old version of me who's just so scared and so alone and has no one to turn to. And he'd sort of peek out and he'd sort of cautiously come over and let me put my arm around him. And then an older version, even the high school versions of me. If you could see my passport picture from high school, it's the saddest thing you've ever seen in your life. Just a blank stare, dead person. And he would come over and just in this Shavasana pose and parts of self, holding all the younger parts of myself and giving them the love and support that they never got because they had nowhere to get it. That's how I finally understood that. And I would do it every Friday.
And that,
I love that.
That comes up spontaneously quite often in EMDR processing work. And then it translates to experiences like Michael's describing here for people. They start having a different kind of relationship with their more vulnerable self or their younger self, so to speak.
That makes sense. One more question for each of you. Michael, why would you say every memory deserves respect? Mm-hmm.
So just so you know where that came from. EMDR, people say MDR, EMDR, forget it. eye movement, desensitization, reprocessing, you can forget that. So I wanted to come up with a in-context set of words that would help people never forget EMDR. So because it's a memory-based therapy, every memory deserves respect. To me, Debbie can give her, she has thoughts about it too. They're markers in our lives. They're there for a reason. You remember them for a reason. And they're respecting and examining and understanding what they mean for you and to you in your life, to me was really important. But mainly, when you tell every member deserves respect, people remember it. And that's EMDR. So it's a way.
Yep.
It's funny, the minute the publisher saw it as a title, because they usually tell you what the title is going to be of your book, I'm sure you know this.
Yep.
Loved it immediately. It was never a discussion.
I think it's brilliant, great idea, because we will remember that much more easily.
Yeah.
And Debbie, last question for you. If somebody who's listening to this thinks, wow, maybe I could benefit from EMDR, but they don't know where to go or how to find an EMDR therapist, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, probably the easiest route is to go to our website, which is just everymemorydeservesrespect.com. And we have links on the website that will take folks to the EMDR International Association, find a therapist directory. There are EMDR therapists everywhere, all over the world. And, folks can search for someone in their area, and there's different levels of credentialing. There's folks that are consultants and certified, and they can take a look at different specialty areas and reach out.
We will link to that in our show notes so that people can go ahead and find it.
Yeah, and I would just say to people, don't get discouraged, right? We keep hearing that, therapist practices are full and it's hard to find therapists these days. I certainly know that in our area. But, don't give up. Be persistent. If somebody's full, ask them who they might recommend, because it's just so critical that if someone is ready to do this work and kind of gets a glimpse of what might be possible, that, that we want to seize that moment and respond.
Definitely.
Also, Amy, we should mention that the book obviously is available Amazon, anywhere else as a book, but there's also an Audible version.
Yes, very important. I know a lot of people who listen to podcasts also listen to audiobooks. So thank you for reminding us of that. Debbie and Michael, thank you so much for being on the Very Well Mind podcast and sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you,
Amy. Thank you for having us.
Great. Just great to be here.
Welcome to The Therapist Take. This is a part of the show where I'll break down Michael and Debbie's strategies and share how you can apply them to your own life. Here are three of Michael and Debbie's strategies that I highly recommend. Number one, acknowledge your past trauma. So often I hear people say things like, I had a really rough childhood, but it doesn't affect me. Or, I've been through a lot, but I'm fine. But sometimes people are more affected by past events than they want to admit. That's not to say that everyone who goes through something tough becomes traumatized. Many people who go through near-death experiences or who witness awful things don't actually develop PTSD. There are several reasons for that. Your personality, genetics, life experiences, pre-existing mental health issues, and the amount of social support you receive right after an event are just a few of the factors that determine what sort of an impact a traumatic event will have on you. Michael said he didn't realize the impact his past had on him until he started getting treatment. And Debbie explains that traumatic emotional events get stored in the brain differently. So it's important to take time to acknowledge any past traumas you've been through and consider whether those things might be having a bigger impact on your life than you might think. Some of my therapy clients have invested years into trying not to think about certain things or avoiding things that remind them of a traumatic event. And then they tell themselves they're not really bothered by those things, but they don't realize how much energy they're putting into trying not to think about something. Remember, if you went through something traumatic, feeling bothered by it doesn't mean you're weak or that you're broken, but it might mean that you could benefit from a little treatment around that issue. Number two, find ways to take care of yourself. Michael talked about how he was a high achiever. That's really common among people who are running from their emotions or trying to escape a painful past. But Michael said no matter how much he did or how much he achieved, he never felt good enough. Part of his treatment involved learning how to take care of himself. That's important, but there are a lot of misconceptions about self-care. It's become somewhat of a buzzword. Sometimes people think they're taking care of themselves when they're just doing things for other people. Like if you get a manicure just so that your nails look good for other people, but you don't actually enjoy doing it, it's not really self-care. Self-care might involve learning healthy relaxation strategies or learning about how to manage the physical symptoms that get stirred up by trauma. Things like yoga, meditation, progressive muscle relaxation, and breathing exercises are just a few examples of strategies that a therapist might encourage you to try. Of course, you can experiment with lots of different strategies on your own too to figure out how to best take time out for yourself. And number three, do some research on EMDR. If you're curious to learn more about EMDR, there's lots of ways to research it. A great place to start is by going to Debbie and Michael's website, everymemorydeservesrespect.com. They have a resource section that will give you information on books, podcasts, and other sites that provide credible information about EMDR. You can also look for an EMDR therapist near you, or you might even look for an online EMDR therapist. Many therapists have found ways to offer EMDR virtually. So if you don't have a therapist near you, it might be an option to get treatment online. Just keep in mind that not all therapists do EMDR. So you'll need to find one who has the specific training to provide it. So those are three of Michael and Debbie's strategies that I highly recommend. Acknowledge your past trauma, find ways to take care of yourself, and conduct your own research on EMDR. To hear more of their insights, check out their book, Every Memory Deserves Respect.
Thank you for listening to the Very Well Mind podcast. If you found this episode informative, please share the episode with your friends and family and leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the Very Well Mind podcast, you can head to verywellmind.com/podcasts.